You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Wednesday, 18 June. We've got local May inflation data due 10 a.m. Looking for another sub 3% number. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, we're going to chat with Ken Nyana. He's from Scope Prime Oil. As Middle East tensions escalate, NPGMs, will they push higher? They are holding on so far. Tasneem Samuddin from Old Mutual Private Wealth. Local retailers moving into beauty for higher margins. David Lloyd from King Alexander Investments on retail investment needing a fairly fundamental overhaul. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb. MTI liquidators hit a snag in the UK courts. You're out of time, it says courts, but liquidators reissue claims against investors. Business Day, agribusiness confidence slips from 14-quarter high. Geopolitics, disease outbreaks temper upbeat look, yet investment and hiring plans remain resilient. Morning markets, US was red, S&P down 0.8%, NASDAQ off 1%. The East mostly red, not mixed. We've got Sydney up 0.4%, Tokyo 0.2% higher, and then Hong Kong off 1.2% and Tencent down 1.75%. Commodities are flat to green, gold futures are flat at 3,403. The rest is green, Brent 76.79, platinum 1,269, palladium 1,067. The rand is 17.99. Bitcoin is 105,000. And top 40 opening call, about 150 points to the red. That's a little under 0.2% lower.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Kia Nyana from Scope Prime. Kia, appreciate the early morning time. The Israeli attacks on Iran last week and, of course, Iranian retaliation certainly sent Brent oil higher. Although I remember conversations with you probably early last year where we were looking at a plus $100 oil. So higher is relative. But what are you making on oil? Certainly we get the challenges. And I suppose a higher oil, the risk to global economies, where we've seen downgrades in GDP due to tariffs, we've seen inflation, I don't know, kind of sticky. Where do you think oil's heading in this environment?
You know, Si, with the new Trump presidency, what he's been trying to do is essentially telling OPEC to bring down the price of oil because the U.S. still remains the biggest importer of oil, and as well has slowed the adoption rate of EVs, and that's exactly what happened. But I was reading a report yesterday that says that the long-term outlook says that we're actually only going to reach the peak of oil consumption only in 2029. Hmm. It was anticipated that that peak would be reached in 2027, which still shows that we still have a supply glut at the moment and demand is not going anywhere. And I think those are the fundamentals of oil in the long term. In the short term, geopolitical risk will affect the interim price of oil because of the fact that at the moment there is a risk to supply if there's tensions in the Middle East.
Absolutely. And peak oil 29. And I must say, peak oil has been, I think there was a Time magazine cover maybe in the 90s, which talked about peak oil. Let's quickly pivot. PGMs, platinum and palladium, both looking good. I got to say, they're holding on this week. I thought we might see some pullback. Are you expecting this sort of breakout in the PGMs to hold? Because certainly the PGM miners and shareholders are quite enjoying it.
I think it was a surprise to see that jewelry demand had grown so substantially in China and Hong Kong. And essentially, that was the first move for platinum miners. And I think because the institutional investor space and investors in the space were not looking out at them as very attractive. And that has just purely been at the fact that supply has literally come off the table. Year on year in South Africa, supply is off about 25%. And the next set of demand, people were not really sure where it was going to come from because of the fact that there's been this adoption of EVs. But as I said, with the Donald Trump presidency, he's not a fan of EV. He's been trying to slow down the adoption of EVs, and essentially that has buoyed the price of platinum. And in that space, the Volterra has been the preferred pick of most investors since April.
Yeah, absolutely. And you talk around that surprising jury demand. I mean, the Platinum Council's, the World Council, has been talking about a platinum deficit last year and this year and next year, which at some point needs to squeeze price higher.
And that's essentially what they have done. I mean, essentially what you've seen, especially from the big platinum producers here in South Africa, is they've just cut down on supply so much, and it's just led to this deficit. And I mean, there's only one way up. Even though there's dwindling demand, there comes a time where now there's a breaking point in terms of that price, and that's essentially what truly happened around the month of April.
We'll leave it there. That's Kenyon Yana. Scope Prime, appreciate the early morning insights. Give your money the return it wants without taking a flight with the Stanlib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Tasneem Samadeen. She is from Old Mutual Private Wealth. Tasneem, appreciate the time. Beauty sales, we have Fashini talking around wanting to get more into beauty. I want to look at it as a sort of broader picture than our local retailers. My first question is there a sense that our retailers are doing enough around beauty in terms of the potential?
Hi, Simon. Thanks for having me today. Yeah, I think our retailers, particularly, I mean, the likes of the TFGs and Apparel, they were really slow into this market. If you think about it, it's really been left to the likes of a Clicks and a Dis-Chem to capitalize on the beauty customer. Mm. And we know globally, the beauty customer has been a lot more resilient than apparel or than homeware, because it's less cyclical. I mean, you have products that you need to replace maybe monthly, maybe every 6 weeks, depending on your usage, whereas apparel is more cyclical. So the beauty customer is definitely a customer that is more defensive, they're more resilient, and it makes a lot of sense for our listed retailers, especially because they don't have a lot of competition from manufacturers. We don't have any opportunities to invest in local manufacturers. So the way we play beauty locally is through the retailers. And we only really have Clicks and Dis-Chem who dominates this market. The apparel retailers, I mean, it's too small for them to even disclose it separately. But they've definitely realized the opportunity. And there is evidence that all of them are now trying to tap into their respective target markets, whether it be value for the likes of a Mr. Price and a TFG, or whether it be luxury in the case of a Woolworths, where they want to be, you know, the destination for luxury beauty. But there's definitely a massive opportunity for them to drive the penetration locally.
Is it around creating their own brands, or is it around working with global brands, or perhaps a blend of?
It's definitely a blend of. We know that locally, if we just take lessons from the global beauty market, even the global manufacturers, they tend to tailor the product portfolio for the local market. You know, the products that sell out in China is not necessarily the same as India or the Middle East. Completely different setups of that global beauty market. What they rely on is the local players. So this is where retailers have the opportunity, particularly the likes of a Woolworths, which already has very strong private label brands. They can easily use that brand loyalty to drive uptake of their own products, and they know their customers. Well, they should know their customers. Yeah. So there's definitely an opportunity for private label, but also improving accessibility to the more global brands.
And I suppose within that private label, in a sense, you're competing with global brands, but you can compete on price. You can also just compete on being local. I'm not an expert in the use of beauty product much, but I'm thinking color palettes. I'm thinking, you know, some of those uniquely South African aspects, perhaps, that they can sort of bring into their own brands.
Yes, unique ingredients like a rooibos, for example, which identifies with a South African consumer. Our color palettes are very different to the likes of an India, for example. So there's definitely an opportunity for them to use what they already know about their consumers to drive that into their private label. The pricing in particular, because obviously global brands, you know, have a certain margin that they need to earn, but our local producers, with their very close ties to China, they can definitely bring it in at cheaper and you know, make it more accessible and drive that penetration with our value consumer. I think that is where the big opportunity lies.
And you were talking around a moment ago around beauty versus sort of clothing, the cyclical nature of it. A beauty customer more valuable, and maybe I could pick up some beauty products, you know, for less than a clothing item. But to your point, I'm back more often. It's more frequent spend. It makes them a better customer, perhaps, for the retailer.
It is a better profile of customer. You know, TFG commented in their results, they launched that value offer with Jet Beauty. I think the brand is called Colors. And they said in the call that they earn a higher margin on that beauty product within Jet itself, even though it's a value offer, than they do on apparel. So it makes absolute sense to target this because you are able to achieve a higher margin. So, you know, that makes your store more profitable. You bring in customers more frequently. It's less cyclical. So it ticks all the boxes for how retailers should be using their space, you know, reducing things that are unprofitable and putting in beauty to drive footfall into their stores and really increase, you know, the resilience of their total revenue base. But it's very small at the moment, which means that the growth rates can be very high going forward if they really focus on the right product assortment.
Absolutely. And I just realized as we were chatting, I'm thinking beauty, I'm thinking makeup. It's truthfully, I would imagine it's wider than that. It's skincare, it's fragrance. It's more than just the sort of the makeup component.
Yeah, so beauty encompasses skincare as well. So skincare has actually grown much faster than makeup, especially with the younger generation. You know, we have in the past, we think of beauty as makeup, as the older generation. But with the rise of beauty influencers, we see the younger girls starting to use skincare in particular much younger in their teens. Yeah. You know, makeup starting in their early 20s, age-related products in their early 20s. So it's a growing cohort of customer, but there's definitely a focus on skincare, which is now the biggest category, followed by your makeup and your fragrances, which also is much bigger in emerging markets than it is globally. So it's a diverse category. And that's where apparel retailers, I think, in particular, because of their big balance sheets, can really invest in order to put out a product that resonates with a South African consumer.
Yeah, and across the age groups. So my niece was using skincare probably from her early teens. And she, you know, not much in the makeup, but she will get there in time. We'll leave it there. Tasneem Samuddin, Old Mutual Private Wealth. Always appreciate the insights. Chatting there with Tasneem, that's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. Is beauty a good category for these retailers to expand into? It looks like they're going to get some nice margins. The market is there. If they can compete on price, perhaps it is. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. Give you money, smoother returns for Stanlib Asset Management. The Stanlib Flexible Income Fund's agile investment process preserves and grows capital in all markets.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with David Lloyd, founder of King Alexander Investments. David, appreciate the time again. Investment landscape. You and I have chatted before, and you're talking around sort of the sense of sort of upending, turning it on its head, giving it an overhaul, whichever one of the alliterations we want to use. It really is a space, particularly for the private client, that is frankly ripe. There's been some. You know, we'll give Easy Equities their credit, but there's still a lot that can be done.
Yes, thank you, Simon, for having me on. Yeah, I feel like the industry has got a little bit kind of stayed and it hasn't changed for decades. And also, it seems to me that the platforms, because obviously everything these days is now technology driven, the platforms, they're all the same. They're all loaded with features and choices and options, which is great. But all of those create complexity, which creates cost. And the platform is charged to the customer. No one's actually kind of taken a step back and said, well, hang on a second. If I was a customer and I was designing this, would I actually have these features because it's going to cost me this amount of extra money?
I take your point. And I mean, absolutely. I mean, the platforms have got tons of bells and whistles. I'm not sure we always need all those bells and whistles. And a lot of this is sort of, as you're talking around designing it, it's around costs. It's like a platform fee, which is a percentage. So as my portfolio grows, I end up paying vast amount for it. It's complexity of knowing what we're actually paying it. It's almost like it's working against me. And truthfully, it is in many cases.
Yes. I mean, yeah, that just doesn't seem right to me for a start. But in part, it's a consequence, like I said, of the model. You may not believe it, but I think I'm right in saying there are 22 of these platforms. They're called LISPs in South Africa, which is an acronym for Linked Investment Services Provider, I think, or something like that. There's 22 of them, and I would say, other than their brand names and their colors, they're all the same. And funnily enough, for example, if you go to the UK, you will find all sorts of different types of platforms that have different services, different fee levels. And in fact, the regulator there actually doesn't allow advisors to only ever use one platform because they say no one platform can be suited to all customers. So really what we've set about doing is not trying to say that we've come up with something better than all the other platforms and everyone should use us. Mm-hmm. Quite refreshingly, we're not saying that. We're saying we should become an advisor's second platform. Whoever they're currently using is great for the majority of their clients, but not all. And that's really the point.
When I was first digging around and having a look at King Alexander Investments, my sense was it was perhaps more of an entry level, perhaps it was someone with a smaller portfolio or something. That's not the case either. I mean, there are key benefits, for example, a flat fee, protection for downside, but it can be for anybody, regardless of portfolio size.
Yes, yes. I mean, look, one of the biggest unfairnesses is that larger investors pay an ever-increasing fee, yeah, which, as I said, it doesn't make sense to me. So we are the first and only LISP at the moment in South Africa that offers a fixed platform fee. And at just 100 rand a month, I mean, if you've just got R1 million invested, ours is per investor family. So if across all of your family, mm-hmm, you've got R1 million invested, you'll see about a 70 to 80% saving straight away. So that's quite a big change from what's out there.
The other big one that you're doing is you pay the same fee for our funds, regardless how they are performing. And you're saying, hang on a second, that seems completely wrong. And you're kind of turning that on its head as well.
Yes. And maybe I wouldn't say that's wrong. I would just say it's unfair, sure, or not client-centric. And let's be clear, our model, we're not saying is cheaper. We just say it's fairer. So if you're expecting and getting really good returns every single month from your funds and from your platform, you may well decide that you're quite happy staying where you are. But for people who feel the investment managers are charging too much for the returns they're delivering, then our model is we refund the advice fee and the investment management fee in its entirety, mm-hmm, including the VAT, every last cent gets refunded every month. And then we only charge you if you're winning, which we set a target for each portfolio, so you know what that is. It will vary by portfolio, but typically for like a regulation 28 balanced fund that an RA might invest, mm-hmm, in, we might charge 35% of any return above 1.2% for the month. So that means every month, if you get 1.2% or less, it's free.
Gotcha. And you make an important point there, is I can move to the platform if I want. I chat with my advisor, but I can, if I need, I don't have to start from zero and start from scratch.
Correct, yes. Look, it depends what type of product invested in, but RAs and living annuities, you can simply transfer. Endowments have these kind of time, yeah, restrictions around them, so you'd probably start that from scratch, to be fair. Mm-hmm. But if you're just investing in unit trust, not in an endowment, then you can also transfer. You just have to be aware in that instance that you might trigger a capital gains tax. But if you stay in the same portfolio, you won't.
Yeah.
But I think most of the switches will tend to be therefore in the retirement space, the either retirement saving with an RA or, mm-hmm, post-retirement with a living annuity.
Olivier, that's David Lloyd, founder at King Alexander Investments. Appreciate the time. That's it for today. We're chatting with Mateta Tulare yesterday from RMB. We're talking the FOMC Federal Reserve rate decision. It is due 8 p.m. this evening, and then there will be the press conference from 8:30. The press conference always tells us a lot more. The question is, what do you think the Fed's going to do with their rate decision? Over half of you said no change, and that certainly is the expectation. 40% said maybe a cut. The rest, which is a small number, were saying maybe we're going to even get a hike. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. If you're loving the show, please leave us a positive rating and an awesome review in your podcatcher of choice. We'll chat again tomorrow. Now is the time for a 3% inflation target.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.